Humidity 84%. Now 74 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're talking today about dementia and especially Alzheimer's, one of the most serious and deflating diagnoses that a person can receive. Because, of course, at this point, we know very little about what causes Alzheimer's, and we cannot cure it. We can, in some cases, slow its progression, but ultimately it is relentless in what it does to the mind. There are things that can be done, things done by caregivers, of whether professionals or family members or whoever it may be, to make life for people contending with Alzheimer's better. And some very insightful and innovative suggestions are part of a really interesting book called Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces, The Unconventional Path to Peace of Mind for Families Facing Alzheimer's and Dementia. Lisa Skinner, one of the authors, writes both from a position of professional expertise and experience in the field of elder care, but also as someone who has experienced this in her own family. 8 different family members have been affected by dementia of one kind or another, and she has lost 4 family members to Alzheimer's. So she has woven some of those personal stories into the fabric of this book. Again, titled Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces. Lisa Skinner, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to say right off the bat, and it might come as a surprise to you, but one of the things that I appreciated about the book, and which I think a lot of people needing to read this book will appreciate, is its relative brevity. That is, if somebody is in the midst of contending with something as challenging as a loved one with Alzheimer's, chances are they are not going to have the time nor the energy to sit down and read a 400-page book, an exhaustive examination of Alzheimer's and every single detail. This book is much more modest in scope. And I wonder how conscious a decision that was for you to write a book that would not take a long, long time for somebody to read. Because, of course, you could have made a very different choice than that. How conscious a choice was it to make this book as brief as it is?
Well, that was actually very intentional. And the reason why is I've been helping families professionally for 30 years now, but my experience dates back 50 years with my first family member. You mentioned in your introduction, I've had 8. And my very first experience was with my grandmother. And I was a teenager, and I went to visit her one day. She only lived a couple miles from me. And she started telling me about these birds that lived in her mattress, and they'd come out at night and peck at her face. And she pointed to her walls. We were sitting in her living room, and she said, "You see all those rats running around my house? They're invading my home." Of course, I didn't see anything. And then she concluded with telling me that these men were constantly breaking into her home, stealing her jewelry, and she was convinced that they were going to eventually do away with her and just take over her life. And between that and my professional training and experience, the one common thing that I've realized that seems to be true for most people, especially if they haven't been touched by Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, is people don't have a really comprehensive understanding of what these diseases do to the brains of the people who are suffering from these brain diseases, and don't really fully comprehend the changes in the brain that occur as a result of the damage. So I wanted to write a book that would provide a, you know, comprehensive understanding of what to expect as a person progresses through the disease, because it's so much more complex than just memory loss and confusion that people associate with Alzheimer's disease. I mean, as they progress through the illness, they really are robbed of most of their cognitive functions. They lose their ability to reason and to make sound judgments about things and to task sequence. And they lose their memory. Yes, that is the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. But personalities change, and they kind of fall back on relying on their raw emotions when responding to situations that arise during their day. So I felt that was the most important thing for people to really kind of wrap their heads around, and that would be their foundation for knowing what to expect on a day-to-day basis and how to recognize that the things that come up, like if they went to visit their grandmother and she started talking about birds living in the mattress and pecking at her face, they would recognize, oh, that's part of the disease. We call that a delusion or a false belief. And the rats were a hallucination that she was having. And the threat of the men harming her and stealing her jewelry, she was displaying to me paranoia and suspiciousness that are also part of the disease. But a lot of people don't relate those things to being part of the disease. So yes, that was the goal of writing this book, was to give people a foundation for first understanding it and then knowing how to proactively and effectively respond to those things that occur.
And again, I appreciate the fact that you've done so as succinctly as you did, because, again, for someone who is contending with this, you know, the thought of sitting down with a huge book of 300 or 400 pages would be daunting, if not impossible. And this is a book that is just over 100 pages long, so you cover a lot of ground, but in a way that is easily taken in by the reader. And I think that was a very, very wise thing to do. The book has an intriguing title, and I think you've already touched on what is behind it, but let's just give you a chance to clarify. Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces. First of all, this matter of truth and lies and Alzheimer's, that's an interesting choice of words. What's behind that choice of words?
Again, that was intentional, because there have been and are still many, many myths, misconceptions, misinformation about Alzheimer's disease and the other brain diseases that cause dementia. So that's really where the truth part of it, because I wanted to write a piece that was just brutally honest with people about what happens to our brains when we do live with one of these brain diseases and how it's consistently changing, and dispel a lot of the myths that are circulating around. Because people really, in my 30 years experience working with families, there are a lot of, there's a lot of myths and disinformation out there that people don't know what to believe. So I wanted to be as honest and candid and transparent as possible in the book so people would have a reliable resource if all of a sudden a dementia diagnosis or an Alzheimer's diagnosis touched their family. And because typically what happens is you get that, you know, just unbelievable diagnosis. You might have suspected cognitive impairment in your loved one, but hearing it from a doctor just completely changes the whole landscape of your situation. And I wanted to present something that was honest and that people could really rely on. The unconventional approach, I get asked this question a lot because the reason why I call it an unconventional approach is because what I've been trained in, I'm a certified dementia practitioner and a certified dementia care trainer. I've got several other certifications that support my expertise in living with these diseases. Because our instinctive responses to situations that come up, such as being told by somebody that there are birds living in her mattress and they only come out at night and peck her face, and seeing rats running all over the house, our instinctive reaction to that is to correct the person. Especially if it's a loved one. We want to fix people we care about. We don't want them to be broken. And when they start talking about far-fetched things that are just unbelievable, we want to try to steer them back to our reality. Now, what my grandmother was telling me was her reality. She 100% believed those things that she was telling me. And it didn't align with my reality, but it was still her truth. And we've learned through decades of trial and error and trying different therapies that trying to correct somebody doesn't work because they believe what they're telling you is absolutely true. So it is kind of an unconventional approach because we have to retrain our brains to think differently about how we respond to people living with dementia.
Right. Another word for it might be counterintuitive because it it kind of flies in the face of usually the path of honesty that I think most people want to live their lives with. I want to give you a chance to talk about a specific instance in which this played out. I mean, I think a lot of us understand to some degree the possibility of when somebody believes that, you know, their sister Myrtle is still alive and coming to visit next week, even though they've been gone, dead and gone for 20 years, that one thing you can do is just go along with that. But you tell an interesting story about a gentleman named Tom and how the staff at the home where he was living engaged in something that you call reminiscence therapy to, in a sense, take this to another level in terms of something that he believed to be true. Explain the sort of compulsion that this gentleman named Tom had because of his dementia, and explain what was done in response to it.
Reminiscence therapy has been practiced, I don't know, it's pretty new, pretty recent, the last 15, 20 years. And the theory behind it is to help a person tap into their long-term memories because it's the short-term memory in the beginning of Alzheimer's disease specifically that damages our short-term memory. So the way I like to explain it that people can really relate to is just think of our short-term memory as having a switch hooked up to it like a lamp does that you can turn on and turn off. And what happens in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's disease, that switch to the short-term memory is on more than it's off. So our short-term memories are functioning. Sometimes that switch flips off unexpectedly. And when that happens, we pull from our long-term memory because our long-term memory stays intact pretty much for the duration of the illness. And when that happens, the person with dementia goes back to a different timeline of their life. And that's different for everybody. And this is the whole reason why a lot of people start telling you that their loved one is alive and well and waiting for them at home, when in fact they passed away, you know, in the past, could be years ago. But their short-term memory switch flipped off. As the disease progresses into the middle stage, that switch is off about half the time and on the other half of the time. And you have to pay attention to the cues, to what they're talking about, to know if that switch flipped off or if their short-term memory is functioning based on what they're telling you. So if somebody's telling me that their husband, and this is another story in my book that's similar, it happened to be my mother-in-law. She was visiting one day, and she jumped up from the sofa and just out of the blue told me, I got to take her home. She insisted I rush her home because Marty was waiting for her to come home and feed him dinner. Well, Marty had passed away about 5 years earlier. And that counterintuitive response that I've been trained on to join her reality and meet her where she's at in her reality, in her life's timeline, really is not the way we instinctively want to react. We want to correct and say, oh, Mom, don't you remember? Dad passed away 5 years ago. What are you talking about? He couldn't possibly be sitting at home waiting for you to feed him dinner. And that's how our gut wants to respond. But that's about the worst thing we could do, because if I had said that to her, it might have been like she was hearing that her husband of 60 years had just passed away and nobody told her. And could have sent her into an absolute panic. So what we've learned is that joining their minds where they are at that very minute, at that time where they believe what they believe, is the healthiest and most honorable thing we can do. We used to practice what was called reality orientation therapy, where you did correct the person and try to steer them back into the healthy person's reality, and it just didn't work. It created panic. It created anxiety. It could escalate to a much more serious situation. We call them catastrophic reactions, which is synonymous with like a total meltdown. It just didn't work. So the state-of-the-art therapy now is this joining their reality, meeting them where they are. And then by the end of, usually by the final stage of the disease, a lot of people completely lose their short-term memory. That switch goes off permanently, and they're living their lives in another time frame. Some people revert back to their childhood, some to their teenage years or adolescent years, some to their prime years. But the way that you kind of figure out where that period of time is, that their heads of their minds have gone back to, is by listening to what they're talking about. And that'll give you a good clue. But that short-term memory switch can turn on again at any given moment. So by prompting them and asking them, you know, discovery questions, you can tell if they're back into the current time frame or if they're still back into another period of their life.
Right. In the case of this older man named Tom, he would wander down the hallways of whichever residential facility he was living in, looking for his office, his old office where he had worked for many, many years. Explain what the staff of this facility did to, in a sense, step into his reality.
Well, this was, just as all the stories in my book are true stories based on either a family member of mine or one of the residents in one of the memory care facilities that I worked at. So Tom was a very prestigious litigator. He was a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and his Alzheimer's disease / dementia progressed to where his short-term memory switch was off more than it was on. And he still believed that he was practicing law because he was pulling from his long-term memory. And every day when the staff brought him into the dining room for breakfast, he asked, he would say, I have to go to work now. And he'd wandered the halls day in and day out, swearing and getting really upset because he couldn't find his office. And so this was back in the early 90s when we were still kind of between join their reality and reality orientation therapy. And initially the staff would correct him and say, Tom, you don't have an office anymore. You live here at the place where he lived. It was called Brighton Gardens, which no longer exists. And he would just become infuriated, insisting that they were keeping him from his work, which was very important because nobody would tell him how to find his office. And then Louise, the administrator of the facility, went to this new training on Join Their Reality and learned the ideology and the methodology of joining somebody's reality. So she retrained the staff and she talked to the family and she came up with the idea that they should recreate his room that he was living in the memory care neighborhood to resemble his office. And the family helped come up with some of the props to recreate his office, and that completely changed the story. He stopped being angry. He'd come out for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, and then he'd go back to his office and sit down at the desk that they provided for him, and he was as happy as could be. And the transformation of his personality completely changed. And that's what he was looking for. He believed wholeheartedly that he was a younger version of himself practicing law. And he was so frustrated because he thought he had been abducted and nobody would let him get to his office where he needed to do this very important work. And this is a true story. And this is also a scenario that comes up on a very regular basis with people living with dementia, especially when that short-term memory switch flips off and they think they are in a different time period of their life.
We're speaking with Lisa Skinner about her book, Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's at Secret Faces, The Unconventional Path to Peace of Mind for Families Facing Alzheimer's and Dementia. One of the themes that you do explore is the really important matter of communication and the fact that, I think at one point you call it a double whammy with Alzheimer's, that not only does the person in question begin to lose their ability to make sense of their world, but they also begin to lose the ability to articulate their needs. And it's really hard to think of a sadder scenario than that, of becoming increasingly confused about the world and what is going on, and at the same time, or at least in many cases at the same time, losing your ability to put that into words, that confusion or bewilderment or fear or whatever it might be. And so you take the time to offer some thoughts for caregivers on how they can more effectively communicate with somebody who is affected by Alzheimer's. And it sounds like some skills that would probably benefit a lot of us in terms of being better listeners and a little calmer in the way we speak and so on. But what do you think is most important for us to remember about this whole matter of communication, the struggling with communication that someone with Alzheimer's experiences, and what we can do to be helpful in terms of our listening and our own communicating?
That is probably one of the most important questions that you could ask me and that I could respond to, because the key to positive outcomes when you are caring for somebody with dementia or you have a loved one with dementia is communication and the way you respond. Because what happens when they lose their ability to tell you their wants or their needs, something's bothering them, they're in pain, it manifests in what we see as behaviors. In other words, they'll be angry, they'll be fidgety, they'll be anxious. They're trying to tell us something, but can no longer articulate what that something is. And then the responsibility falls on us as caregivers and family members to try to decipher what it is that triggered the behavior we're seeing, because we know they're trying to tell us something. And there are all kinds of triggers. There are environmental triggers. There are emotional triggers. There are psychological triggers. And this is where a person-centered approach to care really comes in handy. And when I use that term, I'm referring to now focusing on each individual person versus just focusing on the dementia, the disease, as like it's a one-size-fits-all condition, because it's not. And then it's more difficult in the beginning for caregivers and family members, because you never know what is going to trigger the behavior where they're trying to tell us something really important. But the more we know the person, and we know their medical conditions, we know what kind of medications they're on, so we can check with the doctor to see if maybe they're experiencing, a reaction to a medication, and that's what they're trying to tell us, or simply they're hungry, or they're cold, or they're too hot, or the noise in the room is really bothering them. These are all the triggers, or some of the triggers, of these behaviors that we see. And the better we know somebody, the easier it is for us to really get to the root of the problem. And then we can help them by, taking their sweater off because they're too hot, it's too hot in the room, or giving them a sweater because they're cold, but they can't actually tell us, I'm cold, can you bring me a sweater? So the burden of that responsibility really lies upon the family members and the caregivers. And it's a very difficult thing to decipher because it could be one of so many different things. But the better we know somebody, the easier it will be for us to figure out the trigger. And then the next time it happens, we might, that might be the first thing we'll take a look at. But you go through a process of elimination then and, you know, check to make sure that they're comfortable and, you know, they could have a urinary tract infection. That's a very common situation in people living with dementia, but they can't tell you. So you have to try to rule out what it could be, what it's not. That's a very difficult position to be in.
Right. But, at one point in your book, you call it, you say sometimes it takes creative troubleshooting in order to sort out what's going on and what might potentially be helpful. I remember one of the most interesting stories you tell in the book is about your own mother-in-law. I think her name is Mary Ann. And, and how she would engage in repetitive behavior. You called it fold, tuck, repeat. Tell us a little more about what you observed with your mother-in-law, and typically what is going on when somebody with dementia is engaging in this kind of repetitive behavior. I mean, in a sense, what purpose does it serve, or in what way does it bring them some sort of positive feeling?
So that story, I used my mother-in-law's for the story, but this actually is a very, very common behavior that we see in people with living with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. I used my mother-in-law's as an example because I always thought it was really cute that she would just sit there and fold napkins into fours, and then tuck them away in her purse, close the purse, open up the purse a few minutes later, take the folded napkin out, unfold it, and then start all over again. And she would do this for hours. And what we've learned is there could be a variety of reasons why people show repetitive behaviors. We see it in repeating questions. Over and over and over again in the same conversation. They'll tell the same story over and over and over again in the same conversation. And it really helps family members and caregivers to understand where repetitive behaviors come from. First of all, it has to do with that short-term memory switch flipping off. People who repeatedly ask questions and repeatedly tell stories over and over and over again, it's simply because they didn't remember that they had already asked that question 26 times.
So they have no awareness of the fact that they're repeating anything.
Correct. But it drives the healthy brain people nuts and to, you know, really trying their patience if they don't really understand that what they're observing is the disease, the way it's affected the brain. Now, the tactical repetitive behaviors, like I saw with my mother-in-law, she wanted to do something with her hands. That was very calming for her. But it could also be out of sheer boredom that somebody starts displaying these types of repetitive behaviors where they do, you know, fold towels and then undo them and fold them again and then undo them. There are a lot of different things that they could be doing. So the reasons could be because they are simply bored and they're just looking for something to keep them busy. Or it's because they're nervous about something, they're agitated, they're feeling anxious, and it's calming to do something like that. So you kind of have to read their body language and just really kind of take an objective look to see if you can determine if they're showing signs of nervousness, and that's why they're, you know, showing these repetitive behaviors, or if maybe it's just a case of, I need something to do. I'm just sitting here with absolutely nothing to do, and this feels really good to, you know, fold and unfold and fold and unfold, and just something busy work.
Right. You spend a chapter talking about the phenomenon of sundowning, which I suspect a lot of our listeners are acquainted with, but of course it's this very common phenomenon in which people, as they get to the end of the day, into the early evening, sometimes will demonstrate more serious confusion, as though by that point they're tired and just don't quite have the wherewithal to summon their focus and clarity. And often it is in this period of so-called sundowning that we sometimes see this activity of wandering. And you share with us a term that I've never heard in this context before, sort of a maybe like a first cousin of wandering, aimless wandering, which is called elopement, which can be also just as dangerous as someone who just kind of aimlessly wanders about. Explain what elopement is within this context.
Yes, elopement is a form of wandering, and what it means is the person is trying to escape by any means that they can find to get away from the current environment that they're in. It's running away. It's getting away.
Well, and as you say, typically they have some kind of specific destination in mind. So it's
That's
not
right.
It's not just an ambling away, just kind of looking here and looking there, but it is, in a sense, it has a purpose. And I should think that this is one of the most problematic aspects of someone who is experiencing this kind of dementia, especially if they are not living in a secure facility.
Yes, and it becomes a very dangerous situation. And one of the things that seems to be very common, we see this a lot in memory care facilities, if somebody living with dementia, and if they're in a memory care facility, they're probably at least in their mid to latter stage of the disease. You hear them tell you quite frequently that they want to go home. They've got to get home. And a lot of people's response to that is, what are you talking about? You're already home. Well, in their mind, it's not their home, because where they're at, the environment that they're currently in, is not familiar to them. And if their short-term memory switch flipped off and they're back in a previous period of their life, whether it's their childhood or their adolescence or when they, you know, first got married or they're in college, wherever it may be, they're looking for the place they think they belong in, which is in their past, and they will do pretty much anything they can to get back to that place of familiarity and safety and security. So this is one of the common things that we see that people need to understand, is if somebody is insisting that to take them home or they need to get home, there are questions that we can ask them that can help us determine what home they're talking about, so we can help them help relieve that anxiety by reassuring them that we're, you know, going to help them get there, or, you know, can you tell me what was so special to you about your home, and what was your favorite part about that home? What did your holidays look like and feel like at your home? So you can get an idea of where they are in their mind's eye, and they're trying to get back to that familiar place. Once in a while, when somebody insists that they want to go home, they're actually trying to tell you that they're ready to give up their lives, give up the life that they want to go someplace safe and secure. A lot of times that would be with the Lord or with God. So it's really trying to figure out with each individual person what home means to them, because it's different for everybody.
One of the really tricky matters, and this is touched on in your book, is when we have the children of someone who is beginning to demonstrate symptoms of dementia, serious dementia, and there is a difference of opinion about what should be done and whether or not mom or dad, whoever we're talking about, is still okay to be home versus now is the time for them to be into some sort of facility. And even when it's maybe not even a matter of a difference of opinion, another way in which this is a problem is when it's just a difficult decision to make. And there are ways in which they seem like they maybe would be okay staying home versus maybe they would be safer being someplace else. So even within just a single person, there can be a real sort of conflict of opinion and feeling about this. I'm sure that you have come across this a lot in your work in the elder care industry. What would you suggest that loved ones, concerned relatives, even concerned friends, I suppose, in some cases, how should they approach this matter of the proper course of action, and in particular this matter of have we crossed a line where this person can no longer remain at home?
Yeah. My recommendation is to have family conversations while your loved one, your mother, your father, your grandma, your grandpa, is still of sound mind, and have these conversations with the entire family or the people that will really be mainly responsible for making decisions for them, and ask them what their wishes are if the time comes where they will need full-time care, whether it's due to a medical problem, a physical problem, or they develop one of these brain diseases that causes dementia and they are no longer of sound mind. So that's a conversation that I encourage families to have before they get the diagnosis and are put in a position of becoming reactive instead of proactive, and they can honor those wishes of their loved one instead of, because a lot of guilt happens with adult children when they're trying to second guess what their parents would have liked, because, you know, most of us want to do the right thing by our parents. And when we're put in a position where we have to make those decisions, not knowing if this is what they would have wanted us to do or that's what they would have wanted us to do, then, you know, it creates a lot of emotional turmoil. And siblings don't always agree on the path to take. So the best way to solve that situation is to ask them. And just throw out different scenarios. Mom, if this was to happen, would you be okay with XYZ? You know, do you want to stay at home? We could bring caregivers in. You know, these are our options. And ask them what they want. So then if that time does come, then you would have talked it through. Because not every sibling has the same goal in mind. They have hidden agendas. Sometimes it has to do with money and not spending down their inheritance. Sometimes it's just a matter of they don't agree with putting their parent into an institutional environment. I see that a lot. Hear that a lot. And so we need to come to a meeting of the minds And a lot of it really comes down to, are they in harm's way if we leave them in their current situation, which a lot of times is living alone in their own home? Because if they walk out of that house, that short-term memory switch could flip off. This happened to my mother-in-law, and my family, my husband's family, was divided. One set of siblings against the other set of siblings of her long-term care. And she would walk the dog. She did this for decades. It was part of her daily routine. For a long, long time, go out every morning, walk the dog. And one morning, she took the dog out. She was living with dementia. My sister-in-law was living with her as her primary caregiver. And she took the dog out, and that short-term memory switch flipped off. And all of a sudden, she was wandering around the neighborhood. She didn't know her name. She didn't know where she lived. She couldn't tell anybody her address. And one of the neighbors who had known her for, 20, 30 years, saw her and realized that she was just completely confused, and approached her, and she didn't know what her name was. So this neighbor took her home, and from that moment on, my sister-in-law never left her alone again or let her go out by herself to walk the dog. So the point I'm trying to make here is, a person just in a second's time could put themselves in harm's way if their short-term memory fails them and they don't know remember their name or their address or how to get back to where they came from. Driving is an issue. My grandmother one day took her car out of the garage to go to the store to buy herself some groceries. This is after the episode with the birds and the rats and the men. And that short-term memory switch just short-circuited on her. And she stopped her car right in the middle of a road that was two lanes each direction and was wandering around in and out of the traffic trying to find the entrance to the store, to the grocery store, because she thought she had parked her car in the store's parking lot. These kind of things happen without notice. And then all of a sudden you realize that this could happen in any given moment, on any given day of the week, at any given time. And, not only did she put herself in harm's way, but she put other people in harm's way. So these are some of the things that, if you know that these things can happen unexpectedly, then you want to make sure that your loved one is in a safe environment where they can't be in putting themselves in danger or putting other people in danger. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandmother never should have been driving that car to go to the grocery store. She was, had progressed well into her dementia to where she was a danger to herself and others. And this happens all the time. I mean, I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of similar situations to the stories I just shared.
Right. It's a scary, scary scenario. You write at one point, my hope is that this book will vastly improve the reader's ability to manage the challenging symptoms and behavior associated with brain disease. The book, again, is Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces, The Unconventional Path to Peace of Mind for Families Facing Alzheimer's and Dementia. Lisa Skinner, thank you so much for giving the world this book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thanks again for having me, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, who has essentially joined us on a monthly basis for The Morning Show for the last quarter century, and it will be great to have him back on the program. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. At the moment, we are experiencing some technical difficulties with the podcast version of The Morning Show, but you can still seek out favorite morning show interviews on our archive, which you find at WGTD.org. Today is going to be sunny and hot with a high of 87 degrees, clear overnight with a low of 65 degrees. Tomorrow, much like today, sunny skies and a high of 88 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.